The aim of our Living with Diabetes podcasts is to share information and inspire, and we endeavour to ensure that the information provided in them is accurate. It's not a substitute for medical or health advice from a healthcare professional who's aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. We always recommend that advice be sought from your GP or diabetes nurse before making any changes to medication or before using any products or services referenced by DRWF. DRWF will not be held liable or responsible for failure to seek competent medical or health advice from a professional who's familiar with your situation. Views, information or opinions contained in podcasts do not necessarily represent opinions, standards or policies of DRWF. The inclusion of details about products or services does not indicate DRWF endorsement of them.
Welcome to Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation's Podcast Pro, an occasional podcast series aimed at professionals, where we discuss the results of research projects, training needs, the challenges of continuing professional development, and insights from patient and healthcare professionals. In this edition, we're looking at the latest position statement from the IDEAL Group on how to maximise the impact of diabetes consultations from the perspective of people living with diabetes. The IDEAL acronym represents Insights for Diabetes Excellence, Access and Learning.
One of the first things that was said to me was that I've just lost 15 years off my life expectancy. And I didn't realise, I was angry at that, but I didn't realise the subliminal impact it would have on my decision making and my behaviours over an extended period of time.
Education is an opportunity to be shared at every consultation to make every contact count, but it has to be meaningful, it has to be appropriate, and the language used must be ideal to, you know, reflect language matters, of course.
I think we have to move away from that situation where the healthcare professional is controlling the conversation and making all of the decisions. So it has to be a collaborative, two-way conversation where both parties, if you like, are sharing their knowledge and expertise.
This becomes a whole complex minefield, an interplay between the patient, the community and their faith groups as well, really, in taking a positive and an effective message in terms of health outcomes.
I'm Claire Levy from DRWF. And to help me explore some of the key recommendations of this IDEAL paper, I've been talking to some of the diabetes healthcare professionals and patients involved. I started by talking to the group's chair, John Grummett, who is also living with type 1 diabetes.
So the IDEAL group is an advocacy arm, and the object of it is to address known gaps in healthcare, but to enable others, i.e. basically the establishment, to address those known gaps. So we do that with relationships with any stakeholder group to enable them to change and adopt known evidence-based policies that will improve the quality of care for people with diabetes.
And as you know, we're now looking at how to maximise the impact of diabetes consultations in a 360 view. This time we're looking at from the healthcare professional view and how we get that information across. So if you could just input from your experiences as a person living with diabetes on your own consultations with diabetes specialists, looking at your own care, and why this consultation paper is so important.
So I've lived with type 1 diabetes for 30-something years, 30 and quite a bit, and I was reflecting on this, and I can still remember a comment made at my first consultation, which had a tremendous impact on me, and it wasn't a positive one. And one of the first things that was said to me was that I've just lost 15 years off my life expectancy. And I didn't realise, I was angry at that, but I didn't realise the subliminal impact it would have on my decision-making and my behaviours over an extended period of time. So a few small words can have a devastating impact on people and create bias as to how we think about our diabetes and how we manage our diabetes. So we're entering into this relationship of a consultation where we are seeking advice and we hear what we hear, and that can have devastating impacts, but it can also have very positive impacts. So I think the potential of a consultation goes way beyond the clinical communication. It can have profound impact on how we live our lives. And I think that is why it is so important. I've experienced good and bad. And on the good side, I've been hugely privileged. One could say lucky, but I think it's a bit more than that. To have had some really, really good care. And I'll expand upon that. So I've seen what is great, and I've, to a limited degree, seen what's bad. And I think one of the other important things is that people are a bit fearful to criticise. And I think that's a really bad thing, because that means that things don't change and we need to change and improve. If there's one thing I would recommend to everybody, is to prepare. And that means checking how you're feeling, checking the things that you want to raise, and checking your diabetes management, how it's gone out since the previous consultation, and what you want in the future. If you are prepared, and there are checklists available, you'll get much more out of the consultation. It almost gives you control and enables you to drive it.
Hello, I'm Anne Phillips, and I'm an Associate Professor in Advancing Diabetes Care at Birmingham City University.
And we're looking at maximising the impact of diabetes consultations. What is the average time people living with diabetes spend with a healthcare professional every year?
Unfortunately, a very little most of the time. The average is just estimated under 3 hours. But speaking to a lot of people with diabetes recently, that hasn't been the case. And particularly during the last year, it's been even less because of COVID. Since the introduction of virtual consultations, this has helped. But I think everybody's needs are slightly different. So it depends on when you were diagnosed. And I suppose it depends on individual needs at the same time. But certainly for many people, it's just not enough.
Mm. And during the rest of the time, people are managing their condition themselves. So how can healthcare professionals support their self-management skills?
I think the most important thing is to respond to the individual and where they're at and what their health belief system is. It's difficult. We can't have a blanket education pathway. We've got to have one that's adaptable to meet the needs of every individual. And also we've got to also consider the cultural aspects and ancestry of the individual and trying to investigate where diabetes may be in their life at that time. So education is an opportunity to be shared at every consultation to make every contact count, but it has to be meaningful, it has to be appropriate, and the language used must be ideal to, you know, reflect language matters, of course.
Absolutely. And people do gather information from a whole range of sources. How does this affect their self-management?
It depends where that range of sources are. For example, the BBC have been incredibly labelling recently, you know, not clarifying the type of diabetes they're talking about, and often promoting that it's an individual's blame and fault, which is totally inappropriate. If it's a credible source, that's fair enough. For example, Diabetes UK advice guidance, you know, that's obviously credible sources. But people do surf the net, people listen to neighbours, people listen to people's bad experiences, and unfortunately it can colour their health belief systems.
My name's Jane Diggle. I'm a specialist diabetes nurse practitioner based in West Yorkshire. So I'm part of the Ideal Group. I'm also co-vice chair of the Primary Care Diabetes Society.
Could you just tell us, how has COVID-19 affected annual consultations? Have they made remote or telephone or video calls? more usable? Has it made a difference? How do you feel as a healthcare professional it's affected your ability to work with people living with diabetes?
I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic has, without any doubt, impacted greatly, particularly on those annual diabetes reviews, because obviously a lot of our healthcare services were forced really to focus on the delivery of acute and urgent care. And so that meant that a lot of the routine reviews were largely suspended for quite a considerable period of time, and certainly in most areas. And obviously we're trying to reinstate those services. And of course there are challenges because there's the huge backlog of work. And, you know, inevitably in order to tackle that, teams are going to have to prioritise. But of course, you know, it's not easy for people living with diabetes because I think they've probably felt quite abandoned because their reviews will often be very overdue. I would certainly encourage people to contact their healthcare provider if they are worried about that. Because, you know, I think getting some sort of reassurance and also finding out when they really do need to seek help is so important. And of course, as you say, the other important issue is that in order to minimise the spread of COVID-19, we've moved towards this virtual consultation where possible. So whilst people will probably still be invited into practices to have blood tests and so on, the follow-up is often going to be by telephone or even by video consultation. And that's really quite unfamiliar for most individuals and actually for most healthcare professionals too. So we've had to really very quickly adapt to that new way of working and develop new skills. But it's a challenge because I think building rapport is such an important part of a consultation. And I do think that's more difficult when you're having a virtual conversation, particularly if you don't already know that person very well. And certainly if you're using telephone, a lot of the non-verbal cues are going to be lost. So I think it's quite difficult. And I think a lot of people are very much missing that face-to-face personal contact. But I think we've learnt a lot, and we've learnt that it's not necessarily always required to see somebody face to face. And I think if you think about it, in many aspects of our life, such as banking or shopping, we use IT. And therefore, you know, it kind of makes sense for us to move towards that where it's appropriate. You know, and I think the pandemic has been a catalyst for, I think, what's going to change going forward, because some people do prefer the convenience of having a virtual consultation. But I think we have to be mindful that it's not going to be right for everybody. Some people won't have access to the technology, and even if they do, they might not be comfortable or able to use it. So I think it's a bit of a mixed bag, really.
A bit of a blended approach, maybe, for those who can and want to. It might free up a bit more time for those who want to come into practice and see face-to-face, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think so, definitely.
To have an impact, why is it critical that both people living with diabetes and the healthcare professional are properly equipped and recognise what diabetes demands there are on individuals' lives?
I think the most important thing is to work in partnership and to understand the individual and understand the time that's available for a consultation conversation to make it meaningful, but also to understand where that individual is and what they need to have at that time. It's very difficult because diabetes care is delivered in lots of different contexts. It can be in an emergency situation at a bedside. It can be out in outpatients. It could be anywhere. So different places need different approaches, but the individual has to be in the centre of everything that's about them and for them. And diabetes care needs to be delivered in a meaningful way that makes a difference for that individual.
So looking at an individual response, does that kind of help looking at the way people want to be encouraged? Does it make people living with diabetes appreciate being encouraged by the healthcare professional about how they are, how they feel about their diabetes? How do you manage that?
Well, an individualised approach is absolutely key. what it was key before, and it still is. Everybody wants to feel they're being listened to and recognised as an individual with their own particular needs and preferences that are unique to them. And I think as healthcare professionals, we really do need to acknowledge the demands having diabetes places on a person's life, and that's going to be different from one person to another. So as healthcare professionals, we really shouldn't make assumptions. The only way we're going to find out how a person feels about their diabetes and living with their diabetes and how they manage it is by asking them. And I think we need to do that so much more. You know, we may feel like experts in diabetes, but it's that person who's living with the condition who is the expert on living with their diabetes. And I think our role is very much around making them feel comfortable about sharing what matters to them. And then we can work together to find acceptable ways to manage their condition. So it's a partnership approach that's so important.
Hello, everyone. I'm Professor Mahendra Patel, honorary visiting professor at the City University of Birmingham and a pharmacist by profession.
Can we just talk about why healthcare professionals need awareness that some people living with diabetes might be a bit protective about their own diabetes?
I think that's a very interesting question, really, in terms of protective about their own diabetes. Some community groups and people from ethnic minority backgrounds can, in part, protect their diabetes in terms of not making it very public, and there's almost, in some corners, a stigma in terms of diabetes, and this is not everywhere, but you need to look out for this in certain corners, and if patients present that particular issue when they come to the consultation table to you. And what that means is that, for example, patients that are on insulin may even feel that because they're on insulin, that that diabetes is something that means that they may not be means that they maybe their life is sort of curtailed in terms of how long they're going to live, and also the fact is that they don't want other people to be aware of that, particularly if there's some relationships through marriage with families, etc., that because it's hereditary, then, that's something that we don't want to be telling people. So there can be some time that they will manage their condition very discreetly and very quietly and not let even family members know, particularly if they're on insulin. And even type 2 diabetes, where they're not on insulin, that because it's hereditary and it can affect generations and generations, is how they're seen as from that perspective, really. But I think it's more about people on insulin. Some people may think they're going to die, and there is that issue. So they will be very, you know, be mindful if they're protective and hesitant in coming forward with complying to some of the advice and intervention that we as healthcare professionals will be giving.
So how do you, as a healthcare professional, how do you make every consultation an opportunity for that person living with diabetes and yourself to work in that supportive partnership, sharing knowledge and understanding of the person living with diabetes?
I think we have to move away from that situation where the healthcare professional is controlling the conversation and making all of the decisions. So it has to be a collaborative, two-way conversation where both parties, if you like, are sharing their knowledge and expertise. And, you know, I think for some people, it's a different way of working. And I think some people living with diabetes maybe feel it's maybe a burden to have to make those decisions. But I think it's really important that they do. You know, even where we make treatment decisions, it's very important that they're on board with that, because ultimately, you know, it's the person that goes away and actually decides whether or not they want to take a certain type of medication and so on. So it has to be a two-way conversation.
And do you think healthcare professionals do understand that people living with diabetes, for them, they are the expert in their life, their experience of living with diabetes, and it's the healthcare professional's role as a source of information, support and signposting?
Certainly, I would suggest the majority do, but there are always the minority that maybe don't see it that way. And it also depends, I suppose, on the education, the experience, the exposure of that healthcare professional to people with diabetes. And it's the context, really, and context really matters. So it's setting the context for any consultation or any conversation with people with diabetes to get the messages across, but in a meaningful, supportive way rather than a threatening way.
And how can a healthcare professional take into account the psychological factors that can act as a barrier to self-management and the importance of emotional well-being needs and make sure they're acknowledged and explored in each consultation?
Well, it's simply a matter of asking how people are and listening to what the response may be, because it might be the timing of that diabetes consultation is not at the right time for that individual with diabetes if they're dealing with something else in their lives at that time. So it's finding common ground with everybody, and maybe if it something else is causing the individual some emotional distress and their thinking is elsewhere, which is certainly during the last couple of years has been often the case, then it's trying to deal with that first before you can make any impact about any movement in diabetes care. And that's based on finding common ground with people.
You know, this is the emotional aspects of diabetes are just so important, and they can't be ignored. And I think the psychological factors can have a positive, but of course also a very negative impact on whether a person is able to optimally manage their condition. So I think we shouldn't just be focusing on those physical aspects, because, you know, the mind and body are two sides really of the same coin. And I think this past year, because of the pandemic, has been particularly tough, had a huge impact on many people's mental health and emotional well-being. So we have to acknowledge this more. And I think, you know, it can be a huge barrier to achieving goals. And I try to begin my consultations by actually asking the person how they are feeling, and really try to establish very early on if they have any particular worries, any things that they really want to talk about, rather than us focusing specifically on things like their latest results. Because at the end of the day, all of those results have to be put into the context of that person's life. And it's been a very tough year for most people.
Absolutely. And it's what that individual patient brings to the consultation. It's important that we don't put patients into a compartment, really, because each person will bring their own background and understanding of how they're going to manage their diabetes. And remember that also brings into beliefs, attitudes, behaviours, but also their own state of mind as well, really, in terms of emotional well-being. They may not be well, they may have other complications such as cardiovascular problems, and as we all know, and that could wear people down and think, I've had enough of this, really, and it's my diabetes that's causing all these other problems as well. And it's also, when they're managing their diabetes, how do people, the family, behave towards them, particularly when they're controlling and restricting some of the dietary habits that the larger family would be engaging in? And what does that mean to that individual person, and the resistance that they, you know, the real effort they have to make, because the rest of the family, and sometimes people may be living in extended families, and it's how they're going to manage that, thinking they're the only person out, in terms of eating richly and freely, that everybody else might be able to enjoy, really. And I think the other thing is that the mental health and well-being is key, how their motivation is there. Are they getting fed up in terms of, you know, through self-management, maintaining their weight at a low level, eating healthy food, trying to be active when really they don't, you know, it's not their norm, and how do we make that behavioural change all fitting in to to the wider responsibilities that they may be already having to face, such as family responsibilities. And as I've said, it could be, if they're living in multi-generational families, other members of family that may be struggling with their own illnesses. And also it may be, you know, there could be some financial issues there as well. It's a, it could be a combination of these, very complex. And looking at some of the food types and understanding that, do they actually understand the food labelling, and are they able to afford some of the foods that we recommend sometimes, thinking, I don't know if I can really go out to get some fish and grill it and et cetera, et cetera. Those sort of things all need to be taken into account in terms of the composite picture in getting the best out of the patient and the consultation that, that we're providing to them. And I think the other part is also, if there's other complications, as we know, then you know, diabetes and the treatment behind that adds to multiple therapy. And do they just think, look, I'm just having a cocktail of medicines here that I've just had enough, and should I just drop off a few of the medication, etc., etc.? And is all this medication good for me? What harm is it going to do at the end of the day is also something that they need to be considering. And does that impact on that, ultimately, the self-management and the control of their diabetes, really?
And what about when you're looking at skills with training undergraduates pre-registration and then professional revalidation? How do you help those healthcare professionals to think about cultural awareness and competence and the needs for personalised individual requirements, health literacy, learning styles, and reflecting language matters? Is it all rather a lot for healthcare professionals to think about?
Well, I think it is, but at the end of the day, and I've said often that we are healthcare professionals irrespective of what background we're from in terms of ethnicity, and therefore, one person with a particular ethnic minority background doesn't mean to say that he or she should be able to provide a better service than somebody who is not of a minority ethnic origin. So I think it's more about, how do we bring this training to light? How do we bring this understanding to light? And it is something that we, you know, we need to continue learning. We need to evaluate that learning. We need to look at how that learning is bringing outcomes and positive outcomes and measure that. And then through that, provide appropriate intervention in terms of consolidating our own learning, really. So I think it's more applying those skills, not just a matter of learning those skills and understanding that one size doesn't fit all. The language does matter. The way you and I are talking at the moment would could be very different to different people from different ethnic backgrounds, be it from a South Asian background, be it from a Black and African Caribbean background. We have to tailor that and understand that message. That are they understanding what we're saying, and are we understanding what they're saying, in order to get the maximum out of that consultation? And we shouldn't be making any assumptions. So I think it's more about, in terms of the competency around cultural awareness, understanding, is that we need to be able to look at a clear output measure in terms of, are we really getting to the nub of the differences that the different diaspora bring to the table, and understanding that, and not having a one-track mind, not that we do, but trying to keep away and typecast people from where they are. Undergraduate curriculum is key, and it has to be embedded early in terms of cultural competency and awareness, if we're going to really make it a change that's going to be effective. It's got to be part of everyday practice rather than just something, here's a little bit of training around cultural awareness and competency, halfway through qualifying and practicing, really. So it's got to be part of everyday setup and practice that people become completely au fait with as almost a natural process that they don't have to think about. But having to think about that wider 360-degree perspective of what that patient is bringing to the table in terms of their beliefs, their religion, their attitudes, their behaviours, their experiences, and their own motivation as well, really, which could change from cultures, from different faith groups, etc., really. As we know, for example, fasting is very different for Muslims fasting during Ramadan compared to Hindus fasting, who sometimes have a very, very varied type of fasting, where they could be fasting, long days with very little to eat. Some people have nothing to eat. Some people have intermittent eating as well, restricted eating. You know, all that has to be taken into place into the beliefs and attitudes.
How do you propose healthcare professionals incorporate those theories and principles that support people living with diabetes as an individualised education delivery? How should it form part of every long-term condition consultation and care planning process?
Well, there are obviously lots of theories and principles that support a more collaborative approach, particularly in healthcare and the interactions we have with people. I don't think as healthcare professionals we necessarily need to be experts in things like motivation or interviewing, but I think it helps to understand some of the principles or the spirit, if you like, behind such an approach. So it's all really around working with a person to try to help to strengthen their personal motivation, because, you know, we can't make somebody motivated, because that's something that comes from within, but we can help and support people to feel motivated to do the things that they feel are appropriate for them, and help them to achieve specific goals, explore some of the reasons for change, but do it in an accepting and a compassionate way. I think what we absolutely have to do is resist the temptation of telling people what to do because we think that's what is best for them. I think healthcare professionals do have the person's best interests at heart, but they have to allow the individual to make the decisions themselves on how they want to live their life and how they manage their diabetes.
Mm. And very important, really, for healthcare professionals to access ongoing education, look at the opportunities to maintain their competencies, develop new skills, have access to ongoing professional support and supervision. Is this feasible? Are some healthcare professionals more interested in diabetes than others? And is there a way to improve this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are some healthcare professionals who are more interested and have more skills. Diabetes is an interesting area because things are evolving at quite a pace with regard to diabetes management, particularly in relation to the treatment options. So absolutely, healthcare professionals have to stay up to date with those current developments in terms of best practice. And it's definitely a challenge because, much of diabetes care is delivered within general practice, often by practice nurses like myself. So it's really crucial that they are given access to ongoing professional education, support and supervision. I mean, I do think that a positive that's come out of the pandemic is that access to diabetes education for healthcare professionals has really improved immeasurably. Most are obviously available now online, but are free to access, sometimes even available on demand. So I think that's really good. And I also think that different groups and organisations seem a bit more willing to work together and share resources, which is really, really important. I mean, there is going to be variation in terms of knowledge and skill. There are some fantastic examples of really fabulous service delivery models where, you know, for example, non-specialists can obtain advice and support very quickly. Certainly in the area where I work, we can e-consult with our specialist colleagues. So that saves us having to make a referral unnecessarily, but it means we can get, advice and support on management. And I think, greater use of IT can really improve those channels of communication between, different disciplines and hopefully improve the care for people living with diabetes.
So given the complexity of a consultation that supports people to manage a condition as demanding as diabetes, there's a need to increase the standard primary care 10-minute consultation to 15 minutes. Is this practical in a busy GP setting?
Given the complexity of diabetes and what you need to do in a diabetes review, I would argue that that cannot be effectively delivered in a 10-minute consultation. And I would urge all healthcare professionals who are being asked to do this to challenge it. You know, you do need sufficient time in order to provide a meaningful and effective consultation. So I would most certainly say that 15 minutes as a minimum. But if, you know, you're dealing with something a little bit more challenging or you're starting a new therapy, then I would say that to do that safely and effectively will often require 30 minutes. And I also think that it's a fallacy that a remote consultation is going to be time saving, because I would say not at all. And in fact, in some cases, I would say that perhaps takes even a little bit longer.
Mm. And something that's been an important development is language matters for diabetes care. It's made a difference to the language employed in consultations. Is there still a need for more work around language to be tailored to the individual's requirements and learning style?
I mean, I think there always is. The Language Matters guidance was published by NHS England back a couple of years ago in 2018. And what it did was really highlight the impact of the words that we use when we interact with people living with diabetes. So, I mean, many people are aware of it, but of course, those are people who have an interest in diabetes and diabetes management. But as we already said, many people are non-specialists and may not have a particular interest. So I would certainly encourage everybody listening to read the document. What I probably found most impacting actually in the document were the comments made by those people living with diabetes. So they talked about how awful it felt to be called a sufferer, or to be called non-compliant, or actually to be called a diabetic, because that almost meant that they were being defined by the condition that they happen to have. And I think, you know, healthcare professionals will sometimes use those words, so words that are stigmatizing and judgmental, but they don't realize that they're doing that. So I think it's just around raising awareness. And also, I think giving healthcare professionals some ideas around perhaps some words or phrases that don't cause offence. And that's, I think, what the Language Matters document does very well. So certainly I would recommend taking a look.
Mm. Language Matters has made a profound difference, both within the UK, but also internationally. But there's still a lot of healthcare professionals that aren't aware of it, particularly if they don't work in, for example, specialist diabetes care. So that's why it's really important at every opportunity we promote Language Matters and its ethos and its reasoning, and share the really easy to read documents that are about, and the web resources about how important Language Matters is. And I also think it's important to challenge people, you know, particularly healthcare professionals, where I've heard them perhaps using language that isn't appropriate, to challenge them and question their choice of language, to really just to think, not to embarrass the healthcare professional, but really to get a message across, was that really the most appropriate way to say that? And, you know, people do fall back on habit. We're creatures of habit as human beings, but people do fall back on habit. So it's trying to ingrain those new habits into people's ways of talking and remembering. And it doesn't just apply to everybody with diabetes. It applies to everybody that we, you know, communicate with about their health for any aspect. But in particular, it does have a great resonance with people with diabetes.
And on the other side, is there more work to be done to help people living with diabetes to plan for their consultations in a useful way, to focus the consultation for both the individual and the healthcare professional, to enable them to work together on the important issues for that individual?
Absolutely. And that's why we as Ideal Diabetes have worked together to bring Let's Talk Now, and we have a consultation prompt guide on that, which is a one-page prompt guide for people with diabetes to just record what they may want to ask about, just as a jog, during a clinic or during a telephone call, so they remember what they may want to ask and maybe have been too frightened to ask, or perhaps in previous consultation conversations, the environment wasn't right to ask. We're very worried about timings, particularly in general practice. And often people have said, you know, I'm only allowed to talk about one thing when I go in, and they feel defensive if they have to ask for two or three. But it's important that people with diabetes can record what they want to ask and have that opportunity. And certainly the work of Jane Diggle has been really important in creating an environment, particularly through practice nursing, to enable people to ask the questions they need to ask in a meaningful way and get the answers that they want to hear.
And then following on, active listening and appropriate language from the healthcare professional are critical to make effective consultations, as is having absolute clarity of the outcomes of the consultation, decisions made, actions to be taken. So a record of this should be shared and maintained by both parties. Is there more work to be done to achieve this?
I think there's definitely more work to be done. And listening to a person, using non-judgmental, supportive language, giving them time to express their needs and preferences is really key. And also, you know, in order to achieve the desired outcomes, it's really important that those goals and action plans are clarified during the consultation. And I think also documented and shared, as you say. And I certainly feel that there's more that we could do to embed this in practice. It's really very much the philosophy that underpins care planning. And I think as we gain more confidence in the use of IT, you know, I think that could support the care planning process in the future.
I think that record has to be shared by both parties, but sharing records is one thing. Do we both understand, the healthcare professional and the patient, where we are with this? And it's got to be that common understanding that takes us forward. Written information sometimes can be very difficult, because the interpretation, the nuances in some of the language for different people from different ethnic backgrounds, it is not a literal translation that we need to do, really. And we also have to be mindful that some people from ethnic minority backgrounds may not be able to read their own language as well if we give it in a language in their own mother tongue. So therefore, perhaps sometimes it may be important not to give written information, but more pictorial information where they can relate to and actually take heed on, really. So it is the type of language, that you know, the sources of information that we provide, but also the media through which we provide information as well, really, and who provides that from a community perspective, where we need to be able to reach out to those communities in a fashion that's best for them and not what is best for us or what we think is the best for the wider society, because we need to tailor these messages to the needs of those individuals, those individual communities, and not generalize in ways, really. And language does matter here, because it's just one word that could be taken out of context that could actually make somebody feel very, very insecure in terms of, or confused in terms of where they are in managing their condition. Mm. I think, again, we need to look at the value of using different modes of reaching out to different groups of people. We are now in a world of social media growth beyond imagination, where even it's not just to the younger audience, the more senior and elderly within the community are also being are able to actively use social media. And it's how do we maximize in terms of reaching out to the communities using different methods, such as social media, such as even television, radio programs, and even newspaper news pressings as well, really. And it could be, you know, an Asian newspaper, for example, if you're talking to the South Asian communities, it could be in there for the Indian, in different languages. It is so that we are comprehensive in terms of reaching out to as many people using the different platforms and not thinking, well, let's go for social media and everybody will be able to use it. Let's put it through a particular national press in their own language and everybody be able to access it and understand it. No, no, no. I think we need to look at all this together and make and pick out which what is going to work best for which community and which individual the most, really.
Mm.
I think the other thing that I'd like to add is that we often talk about reaching out through faith leaders and place of worship and community organisations. These are powerful resources to work with, understand, build those relationships, but it can't be done overnight and it needs that trust and confidence to be able to get the wider message out to people within their communities. But the other thing is that you've also got to remember that how much waiting particular leaders have as well, really, because you can't just suddenly say, well, the imam has so much, you know, as we know we're within Islam, the imam's voice and the waiting carries hugely within the Muslim communities. But does that correlate to the same with a priest in a small temple for Hindus? That does that have the same weighting as well in terms of giving that message out? And would that message be adhered to as much as somebody from, for example, as an imam would to Muslim community? And it's the same looking at the different faith groups, reaching out to gurdwaras, temples, mosques, and even churches for the you know, and when I say I in and even, I've only said that not from a belittling perspective, but more from the fact that an inclusive perspective as well, that we have to realise that some of the Indian diaspora are also Christians, as are the you know the black community, and therefore, are these the areas that we need to focus, but look at them on a single level and work with them to understand how they operate, what their needs are, and how they can best reach out to their communities. So this becomes a whole complex minefield, an interplay between the patient, the community, and their faith groups as well, really, in taking a positive and an effective message in terms of health outcomes.
To get more on a patient's perspective, we telephone John, who's had type 2 for over 20 years and takes insulin twice a day. I asked him what he'd like his care to be like.
In an ideal world, which of course we're not living in, I'd like it to be comprehensive and consistent with mutual involvement between me and the GP regarding checkups and long-term plans, etc. And perhaps more identified support networks between perhaps the area health authority and the doctor surgery, that sort of thing.
And can you give examples of good things regarding accessing diabetes care that you've experienced?
Well, I have to say that pre-pandemic, I was always very positive and very happy with the care that I got from our surgery. I used to have 3 monthly blood tests. I used to have face-to-face appointments, and the doctor always explained the blood test results. He'd turn the computer screen round to show me the different results and so on. I had annual foot checks and retinopathy checks. But obviously, with the pandemic and the problems that we've had, that has all changed, really. So pre-pandemic, everything was really fine. Post-pandemic, obviously, they're under great pressure. It seems to have changed significantly.
Mm. So what do you want your healthcare professional to tell you, and how do you want it to be told?
This is the ideal world, isn't it, really? Mm. You want face-to-face consultations, And I have to say that during the pandemic, I did ring, I think, on two occasions when I had something wrong, not, again, diabetes related. And I did get a face-to-face appointment with the doctor. But I know it's very difficult at the moment to go back to the old system because the system is at breaking point almost. But I'd quite like face-to-face consultations and my blood results explained to me, which previously they did, plus kidney function and cholesterol and all those sorts of things. I just want a sort of more consistent, really, and coherent way of dealing with and not having the feeling that you've been abandoned.
Do you have any suggestions on how the diabetes care can be improved?
Again, I think it's a case of trying to catch up with blood tests and also with like the foot and eye screening. I usually have an eye screening in June, but I've not had a letter yet about that. And I've decided to pay now privately to see a podiatrist. So I'm seeing her on Tuesday. So I'm actually trying to compensate for, the sort of failings of the system, really. And really just to have more confidence that the system is actually working.
Mm. So how has having diabetes made you feel over all these years?
It's just something you live with, basically. I mean, I've had it for a long time. I do test my blood sugars. Sometimes, say at the moment, I've got another unrelated feeling ill issue. So my blood sugars are a bit all over the place. So hopefully when I have my blood test on the 8th, something can be done about that. But I think the problem really is lack of motivation. Having to shield for nearly 18 months, not see people, not go out. It's had the effect really of I've put weight on because until recently we couldn't go out for exercise. And basically it's just that feeling that, you're sort of locked in, in your sort of homely prison. You just feel that, life is really difficult. I mean, obviously now we've come out of that shielding thing, but my wife had a liver transplant 2 years ago, so she's had to shield, and I've really had to make sure that I've, done the same in order to keep her safe, really. As I say, I think that it's about, there's a problem, really, I feel, about a lack of monitoring from, healthcare professionals.
And do you think your emotions and reactions to being diagnosed with diabetes is taken into account when discussing your diabetes?
It isn't. No one ever asks about my mental health or how I'm feeling. I have to bring it up. I mention it about how I'm feeling, the fact that, I've got low mood and, lacking in motivation and so on. And I think that the pandemic and the shielding heightened those mood swings. My wife coped with it extremely well because she's got lots of interests and hobbies. I haven't. So therefore, I have had sort of quite low mood swings. But when I have an appointment on the phone or face-to-face, it never comes up in conversation until I actually bring it up myself.
Yeah. So can you give us some feedback about the types of words or language used by healthcare professionals with you when you're talking about your condition?
I have to say, I've never had a problem with this at all. I come from a professional background anyway. I have sort of enhanced language skills. And when I go down or speak on the telephone to a doctor, diabetes related or not, I always feel at our surgery that I'm talked to as an equal. Mm. I'm never talked down to. I don't feel patronised in any way. Things don't go over my head. If I don't understand something, I will say. And in a sense, I know the questions to ask. So therefore, when I do have an appointment, I go with a piece of paper with the questions written down. I don't just think of things at the top of my head. And also, I'm not afraid to commas, to challenge people or doctors or nurses if I will actually question them about it.
Yeah.
So that has never been a problem.
So do you have any suggestions to help other people? I know you said about taking in your list, and what could be done differently or better?
I think perhaps thinking outside the box of a surgery, perhaps more self-help groups available, that like the one we go to, meetup we take, and courses initiated by the surgery and by Walsall Healthcare. I did do a six-week course in February, I think it was, of this year, with the Walsall Healthcare self-care area department, which was specifically for diabetes, for people with diabetes. I had done the longer course about 4 years or 5 years previously, and I was a little disappointed in the sense that it was basically the same thing that was sort of brought back up again. And although I did take some positives from it, a lot of the time it was a combination of pulling teeth and watching paint dry. So I think there could be better sort of access to self-help groups or people who getting together advantages of, in the sense of doing the Zoom meetings and things, is that you do have an opportunity to meet other people, other diabetics, and discuss various things. And I think, again, with other people, it's a case of being afraid to ask the questions. And if they don't turn the computer around to show you the test results, to actually ask them to tell you the test results, and be sort of more proactive, really, in that sort of consultation.
And that final comment brings us to the end of this edition of DRWF's Podcast Pro. Our thanks to the Ideal Group and all the guests who participated. We welcome your feedback and any ideas you may have for future podcasts. Please email us via the contact form on our website, drwf.org.uk. DRWF produces a consumer podcast called Living with Diabetes, which you may also find of interest. It's available via our website in the news and events section and on many major podcast platforms such as Spotify, Apple and Google. This is Claire Levy. Thanks for listening.
DRWF's Podcast Pro has been a Blue Aurora Media production.